Blog Talk Radio. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Neil and Kristen Baker Psychic Hour. Today, we are talking about the inner and outer life and taking calls for on-air readings. So, callers, 914-338-0164 is the number you want to call to reach us today on the show. And please do press 1 if you would like to speak with us. We do have a caller, 508, but 508 has not pressed 1. Do you want to speak with us, 508? 508. Is not pressing 1. Okay, so I don't know if 508 wants a reading or not. I just lost my computer screen. I have a blank screen and a spinning wheel. So hopefully the listeners can hear us right now. Now it's back. Okay, I'm going to bring 508 on just because I am not sure. And our private caller that just came in, if you would like a reading, please call back and unblock your number. Hi.
Hey guys, it's just me. It's Mary. I'm just listening.
Are you wanting to listen? I wasn't sure if you heard me or.
I heard you.
Well,
you know me. I always push 1 if I want.
Okay.
I know. I was just listening, you guys.
You're just listening?
I am. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. You're welcome. Okay, so currently, Neil, we are just chatting.
Well. A little bit more than chatting. We're talking about
verbiage.
the inner and outer life, meaning the life of the...
That's just idle chatter, isn't it?
Yeah. The life of the spirit as opposed
it's
to the
physical,
life of the...
Physicality.
Of the body, yeah.
Well, and they're always not... I mean, you know, of course, when we're... Most people are focused on the outer life. I mean, to be honest, if we look at the world we live in, society, it's the outer life that the emphasis is on. The spiritual life isn't always put in the forefront. I mean, depending on, you know, who you are, that varies, of course. But generally speaking.
Unless you set out on a course of leading a purely spiritual life, you're going to the priesthood or the church or synagogue or whatever it may be. You become a devout Buddhist or a Muslim or whatever you want to be. If that's your devout energy, then you have your inner life becomes the predominant force of life. And basically those people are, their DNA is wired that way. Maybe something's happened and they go into it because of some event or tragedy or something or a conviction. But a lot of people, their system is geared to be comfortable in that kind of a role and playing out that kind of a life. And to no discredit to most of us just have to live on the planet. We're alive and we're living on the planet, and there's nothing wrong with having a physical life. We wake up, we eat, we have our likes and dislikes, our hobbies, we go to work, and then our concerns are what? Basically still of a physical nature. Relationship,
job,
and money,
you know, acquisitions,
things like
you know,
that,
in terms of material,
our artistic endeavors, they all sort of surround the physicality of life. Even if one is trying to seek a soulmate, or if one is trying to do social work or something higher. It's all still a matter of the physicality of life. We seem to think that leading a physical life is something base and somewhat conventional and narrow-minded, but actually leading a physical life is obviously something that we can do with some sense of spirituality and conviction.
Right.
And
I mean, if we talk about people that are humanitarians, helping people, you know, that are poor or, you know, that even is, or being of medical assistance to people, that is still a physicality of life.
It is. I mean, it is.
I mean, there's a higher chakra energy
zone going on,
right?
It can be to a high idealistic degree, and a person can have conviction for what they do and surround it with a sense of altruism, things like that. But when you get into the broadness of a physical life can still encapture those aspects and aspirations and characteristics. The inner life is different. You almost know when a person's leading an inner life because their whole world is surrounded with causes of spirit. You don't really hear dialoguing about relationships. I mean, people who have relationships can be spiritual, but a purely spiritual life goes into a whole mystical realm. A person goes into deep study.
Sometimes they become, and you're saying that people that are very spiritual can be in relationships, but oftentimes it involves being on a solo route, like a monastic type of life.
Right. We're not saying that people who lead a physical life aren't spiritual. What we're talking about is the pure inner energy of a spiritual life. When you talk to a human being who has a pure inner energy of the spiritual life, they don't know what movies are out. They don't know what's on TV. They don't know what the popular trends are. Their whole mind, their dialogue, you can't talk to them without them talking about spiritual matter and develop study. They're just into that. And you know you're not going to be engaged in a worldly conversation with them. Internal spiritual people may have some briefing of the world. They may be able to discuss world situations. Indeed, even the Pope is concerned about the environment and refugees, and he's into things, and he has his certain pleasures and likes and dislikes. It doesn't mean that a purely spiritual person can't move into the outer world and become involved. But we're talking about what is it to have if the essence of a human being is purely spiritual, and there are human beings walking on the planet that are like this. They almost seem like aliens. I mean, they don't fit into the normal fabric of life. Their whole life, they're almost secluded. They're almost like hermits. They all they do is study and study and study and probe the mysteries of the spirit and read whatever they're reading, the Quran, the Bible, whatever it may be. Or just spiritual material, people who are cosmic beings, and they spend the
separating
entirety of their life
separating from any ordered form of religion.
Religion, they are engulfed in matters that pertaining to the astral realm, and astral projecting, and angels and spirits and guides. It's almost like if you go to visit them and they're a reader, that's all they do. People come and they read them, and then the people leave, and they're always in this cosmic consciousness.
Okay, so a modern day example of that kind of person. I mean, who would you choose?
Well, I don't know. There was a funny Woody Allen film called Broadway Danny Rose, and Mia Farrow went to visit this psychic woman who sat in bed surrounded by her helpers, and all she did was give readings. And people were lined up. It's a comedy, but people were lined up outside her door waiting to get a reading. And this woman would give information like in a relationship, go to him, he's waiting for you. She would give information pertaining to the world, But this woman didn't.
She was isolated. Okay, so that's like an example. But I'm just thinking who. You know, I mean Norman Vincent Peale, but I mean he was involved in the world because he was publishing a magazine, you know, the Guidepost magazine, and writing.
A restaurant.
I'm trying to think.
He was a social character too. I mean,
you know, the Dalai Lama, which is not, you know, someone I'm promoting necessarily, but he's also involved in.
I would imagine
the public
there are monks,
for sure.
Tibetan monks. There are nuns.
Usually they're not well-known people, right?
They seclude themselves. They are almost, I don't want to say imprisoned, but they voluntarily must go into a world within a world where they are secluded.
Well, like cloistered nuns, the Carmelite order, for instance, are cloistered nuns. They do not interact with the outside world. They just pray and pray and pray. And there is some involvement in different aspects of interacting with people, but I mean even there is a cloistered nun I knew, who a Carmelite nun, and you visiting her, we would have to visit with there's a partition, so they don't even, you know, touch outsiders.
You know, they don't want to touch, and it comes from Christ, you know, don't touch me, I haven't ascended to my Father yet.
Right,
but when
exactly.
You're in a, when you're in a strong religious energy, yes, there's Tibetan monks in Nepal that live high up on the mountains, and they are totally secluded, and all they do is pray. Now, there was also this Catholic priest who was accused and actually somewhat condemned for sexual misconduct, and he has now a life of penance. And all he does is he's secluded in the church, in wherever he is, the church, and he has to do penance for the rest
penance?
Of his life.
Penance?
Yeah.
So he's, I don't know who you're talking about, but he didn't go to jail?
No, he was reprimanded by the church.
Oh,
and
that's great.
And I don't know the exact circumstances of the case.
There
are people who voluntarily... And you don't have to go to a mountain. You don't have to sit in your bed. And you don't have to be secluded behind walls. There are people who, you know, they go out, they market, but they're very quiet. We've gone to restaurants and we've seen Tibetan monks in a lot of Thai restaurants that come in. They're obviously
Vietnamese restaurants.
But their whole life is devoted to spirit. And that isn't to say that someone can't enjoy life, laughter. I guess spirituality has its variants. Some people who are totally devout will still watch TV.
Well, it does. And like the examples that I gave, Norman Vincent Peale, the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa. I mean, these are people that were out in the world and they're interviewed. And so, you know, there's that dichotomy of living a very spiritual life of service, but also being very much involved in the media, so on and so forth.
I think, you know, without prejudice, it's the content of the mind and the brain. I'm sure there are people even who call our show and they consider themselves to be very spiritual, but agreeably, their main concerns are maybe job, a relationship. When am I going to find somebody? When am I going to get that job? Do you see me moving? These are the questions they ask, but these are not questions that are asked of a purely, you see, spiritual person.
Right.
You know, can you imagine a purely spiritual person inquiring about, am I going to get a relationship? Do you see me getting that job? They won't go there. They won't go there. They're not concerned about it. And yet we have to still define them as part of the human race.
So even if there's that desire for maybe a companionship, that person is not seeking answers, they're more in harmony with the flow of life and energy.
You know, you marry God, you marry Christ, you marry Mary, you marry Buddha. That's your marriage. That's your relationship, and you spend your whole life investigating the contents of that connection.
But you can be, I mean, come on. You can be spiritual people, very spiritual people, and be in a relationship, obviously.
What I'm saying that there are those people
who are
exclusively spiritual.
Of course.
And yet we have to define them as being part of the human race. And And that is the pure essence of spirituality. Just as you can have the pure essence of physicality. You know, you can be a Hemingway. You can just go out and travel the world and experience everything. Fishing, hunting, love, wine, music, women, writing.
Sounds good.
Bullfighting.
Not
you know,
good. And
even his literature was linear and condensed to non-decoration. It was a purely a survivalist type, not survivalist, but a man's man world, a purely physical energy of life. And that could have luster in it and passion, of course. I mean, he did some fine works, Farewell to Arms and the Spanish-American War and things like that. But the idea that you can contrast, you can take two human beings and see someone who doesn't really ascribe to spirituality, except maybe in their own idealistic way. Idiosyncratic.
Idiosyncratic way. Sorry.
And,
I misunderstood you.
Maybe Meyer too. But the idea that you can take two people and they're both human beings and one expresses the pure spirituality of physicality and the other one expresses the pure physicality of God consciousness, of a religious life, for want of a better word. And the two are very, very separate. And then in between, we have all these variances of personalities and egos and energies that compromise the extremes of either being a purely physical person or a purely spiritual person. But I think what's interesting, and maybe for our callers too, is what kind of person are you? How much percentage is your life of spirit? And how do you define that in a very objective way?
Well, what's kind of an interesting idea is those that are seeking psychic answers for a physical result, you know, and maybe are wanting, not completely getting the things that they want in life. And, you know, the thought that maybe when these things are attained, that there will be a movement into a more spiritual life. Like, what's that?
Yeah, well,
you know,
people love to peek behind the curtains. And if they think they can meet someone who has the ability to peek behind the curtains, so be it. They're psychics peek behind the curtains. They can see beyond. So if someone can seek psychic advice, I've had a lot of wealthy people who have come to me, very powerful people, and have sought my information, my advice, my insights, my predictions, and there isn't yet a real spiritual bone in their body. There's no content about
right.
The soul, the spirit. They just feel that I'm a commodity, that I could be used, that I have information, and they seek that to accommodate the physicality of their life.
But you know, in terms of those that are seeking spirit and profess to have an interest in spirit, but are really bogged down by the struggles of day to day life, and profess to could be committed to spirit, but really are inundated with all these problems, and then you know, say that they're going to be committed to spirit once things clear in their lives, or you know, they're going to have time for spirit once they're able to get everything in order.
Well, the thing about spirituality,
which is like kind of
people of a spiritual nature
are of a spiritual nature, no matter whether they're
a lot of the role of a spiritual person is to help the oppressed. So sometimes people come to psychics and mystics and strong religious figures for help, for true help, not to satisfy the cream of the ego, but to really help. I mean, Christ himself he had collisions of masses of people who were trying to seek help from him and guidance and that touch of some kind of redemption or release from pain. So we have that in all kinds of figures. Moses leading the people out of the land of Egypt and crossing the desert for 40 years, supposedly, and the concept that there are prophets that we go to, and mystics and messiahs that we seek because we feel oppressed. We're belittled by dominant forces. And so that's a different kind of approach to spirituality, because it comes from a need, desperation. It doesn't come from an attitude of just my ego is satisfied by meeting somebody who's a mystic and they can tell me things and it's gratifying to my ego. So what do you see? So you see me with a woman coming soon? You know, and they got $50 million in the bank. I mean, that's different from somebody who has nothing, who is just trying to seek some kind of.
Well, these are extremes, though.
Sure.
You know,
talking about extremes.
They're extremes.
But we're also talking about the individual journey that we all take. And, you know, everyone at the end of their life, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but one question one might ask themselves is, how much of a spiritual being am I? And as they're about to exit...
That's probably the worst time to ask at the end of the life.
It all depends on how you've led your life. You know, we all are going to come to an end of life.
Usually, there's going to be more introspection and examination of, you know, our conscience and how we conducted ourselves on the planet and matters to spirit. And often, you know, it's
well, some people take life as a stream of consciousness. You know, some people get to the end of life, they go. And my mother said this, I've led a good life. I was married. I had children. I traveled. I had fun. I had a fulfilling life. I got a degree. You see, everything is based on the concept, and she was agnostic. Everything is based on the concept of, did I have a fulfilling life? Did I get the most out of life, the gusto of life? Did I do as much as I could?
And enriched.
Am I ready to leave?
Yeah.
Other people might say, oh my God, I'm dying and I'm entering a new journey, a new world. Am I prepared? Have I packed my bags enough to know that I'm not going to look bare naked when I get over there? That I have satisfied enough for my soul, not the soul of going to Switzerland and skiing or getting a degree in school, but the soul, the nourishment of the soul that's in terms of studying the afterlife. And we're not talking about, you know, entertaining the public because you're a tarot card reader or you're a psychic or you're into Reiki or whatever. We're not talking about that. Those are fine services. But that doesn't prepare one to move into the spiritual realm if one is considering that that is a real domain and that while you're on the planet, you're supposed to be nurturing that pure spiritual energy that will be following you after the world is done, because this world will be done for us. So I think there are some people who take that to heart and they think, you know what? I've got maybe 70, 80 years on the planet. They finally come to a place where their souls have evolved and they start thinking, if this is the last time on this planet that I walk, am I going to be prepared to cross over and maintain an existence on the other side without consequence? And those are the people who go into deep study because what we don't see, they see. What we don't know, they know. They see things we don't see. They hear things we don't hear. And they believe that there's a realm on the other side that one must be prepared for and well-dressed for in order to maintain and extend their existence there.
Right. So I guess the question for, you know, a lot of the people that call our show, that listen to our show, is how to maintain a spiritual life while living in the physical world and keep, you know, balance the two so that they are complementary to one another.
Well, you can do so in a conventional manner, you know, like the food pyramid. You know, you separate everything and you
right.
have your spirit and you
well,
have
that's...
your fun and you have this and you separate everything and you think by these segmented motions of behavior that you might be able to just feel that you've had a balanced life. And maybe that may be true. I mean, we are hardly hermits. We are not of the purely spiritual
you
nature.
And I, you mean?
And I, yes. Oh. I mean, we're not living in a we are obviously, you know, we
in
like our bagels and, you know, we watch our forensics, you know, crime shows. We are in the world. But yes, do we spend a large percentage of our life, which we do, dedicated, devoted to spiritual energy? Spiritual energy and the examination of that.
Yeah, I mean, if we were living purely physical lives and, you know, living according to all our desires, this may not be how it looks. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, we are devoting, we make sacrifices.
Sure.
In our lives. And that's more than just saying, well, you know, we make sacrifice. No, we make real sacrifices in order to be of service to others.
We do.
So.
And to a purely physical person, they may say, my God, you two really have devoted your lives to spirituality. God, you're working on this book of numerology and it's broadening the concept of what it is, and you do radio show and you do readings and you do all this stuff. Oh my God. And then a purely
aside from that, I mean, it's our, you know, our work together, the third eye and your communication
that,
with guides
that.
And
we're
spirits
doing,
aside from, you know,
right.
the practical
but
things that
a,
we're doing with
a
people.
A monk may look at us and go, you're very worldly.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I don't, you know, that's
so
fine.
We see those monks out at those restaurants.
Well, you know, it all depends on whose perspective you're looking at. Now,
it
you
does.
Know,
I mean, if
broader,
we're talking about people that are, yeah, completely removed from the world,
now,
of course we
right.
want to be worldly.
We're still worldly. We are definitely worldly.
Yeah.
So it all depends on, you know, if you're going to segment, if you're going to put these, separate the aspects of a person's behavior, fine, you can do that. And we don't know where the line is to pure transcendence. I mean, some people say, oh, they were a good soul. They always sacrificed. They gave. They never said a bad word. They were always helping. Oh, let's look at all the lists of the things they've done for the world and for people. Maybe they'll cross over. Maybe they will. But, you know, how we look at human beings to define how a person is physical from spiritual, you know, when you go to funerals, oh, this man, he made a whole room laugh. He's probably making the angels laugh now. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the person is. But how we define...
But in terms of, you're saying that the ability to make people laugh and the fact that you bring joy to someone's life is not necessarily a qualification for being able to transcend. It takes
isn't.
More.
Unless,
so you can be a great person on the planet, but it doesn't mean you've checked all the boxes to
right.
get off the
I
earth
mean,
forever.
It all depends on the viewpoints of human beings who are on the planet, how they define spirituality and what spirituality is. And that discussion is never going to be handled significantly and predominantly as one-sided. There's no end to that conversation.
Well, I mean, it goes back to, I mean, obviously being of service, being of great service to the planet is going to be a serious qualification for transcendence. But going back to what I said originally in the beginning of the show about being humanitarian, for instance, you can serve the world, but if you have an actualized spirit, it's going to be tough to graduate. So you can be someone who is of great service, donate money, you know, be in the Peace Corps, whatever it is. But if you're, you know, agnostic, for instance, and you don't really have a spiritual life, then, you know,
well, yeah,
it's going to be hard.
And it's hard, you know, when we get into that subjective area, it's really hard. When you look at the leaders of countries, the leader of Israel, the leader of Pakistan, when you look at all these different countries and people who are devout and dedicated to their religion, to that whole concept of what they totally believe in their relationship to themselves and God, their religion, their practices. I mean, you can still have very devout, dedicated people who are in the world and making a passage through the world to where they're also political beings and government beings and legislatures and ministers and people who are ambassadors, people who have, when you look at the whole scope of what we're doing down here, there's two concepts. One is taking care of the world and being involved in the world. and the other is being prepared for the afterlife. And how one leads their life is somewhat subjective. I mean, but at the end of this story is, we're all going to have to ask ourselves, who were we as human beings? Were we physical? Were we purely of the body, including having emotions and aspirations and certain beliefs and
right.
being good citizens? As opposed to that, or in contrast to that, how much spirit was really there? And how much spirit was there that was devoid of the ego? Spirit wasn't used in order for us to find something we wanted.
Right.
You know, a material thing, a
right.
person, a job, a house.
A career.
You know, and then we can say, well, we're a very spiritual person. We go to psychics.
All right.
You know, and we're always asking, and we burn candles. These things are just accessory. They're not the pure nature of spirit. The pure nature of spirit is something else. And we admit we're devoid. We fall short of that. Even where we stand, we fall short of being purely spiritual beings. And that takes a certain DNA, I think. It takes a certain commitment.
Right, but it's not only a commitment. I think it's a specific path. I mean, there's destiny involved in many of our lives, and there's something we decide or we're sent down here to do. So those that are monastic, that live their lives in that individualized spiritual life, that's their purpose on the planet. I don't think that for you and I, that was what we were sent down to do, obviously, or we would be connected in this way.
You know, I don't know. That just isn't where we're centered. You know, but
I mean, we could, if you wanted to, you know, separate and join the convent. You could, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're more in a rounded situation of life where we're totally devoted to the nature of spirituality, but we're still of the earth. It's hard to be not of the earth and in the earth. That's what this concept is. Being a spiritual person, and you are a physical being, but you're not really of the earth. Christ said, I'm not of the earth.
But there have to be people, right. There have to be people in the earth that are spiritual, that connect to others in the earth, versus people that separate themselves completely from the world. Because how would people that aren't spiritual or may become spiritual as a result of a connection to those that are spiritual in the earth, you know, connect? How would they connect without people that were leading the way? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. Sometimes there's not really a need to connect. If a person is totally spiritual and they're going to lead a solitary life.
I'm not saying you're missing my point. What I'm saying is there's the purpose of those people that don't connect, but mm-hmm. there's the purpose of people such as ourselves that are in the world, but are also spiritual. There are different purposes. That's what I'm saying.
Well, sure, there are different purposes. But when we're looking at the terminology of connection, we're also examining what is one's connection as long as they're on the planet, in the world. You know, what is the connection we have with this planet? I think that, you know, if you want to put trite conversation to it, God means us to enjoy the world. He wants us to enjoy mountains and food and laughter and entertainment and singing and joy and all that. I don't think that in order to please, quote, God, that you have to seclude yourself and just praise him.
Obviously
and
not.
Study him. So I think there's a time, you know, in Psalms, there's a time for everything, a time for every season. There's a time for laughter, a time for crying, a time for... So I think that the idea of the concept of existence and how we experience the world, we have to finally come to some form of agreement with the world. How are we going to be in the world and enjoy it? And at the same time, know that we're predominantly spiritual beings. And I don't mean that you light candles, you know, you do all these rituals and
burn sage and, you know, play with
I'm
your crystals.
I'm not talking about those things. Who cares? Do you do it? You don't do it. Who cares? What we're talking about is the true nature of the inner quality of the person, not what comes out in terms of their ritualistic endeavors and habits, but what is the core essence of a person's energy. And that's what I think is the content of the soul. So when we look at the content of the soul and we see how it's reflected into the flesh, into the body, then we can get some idea what makes a person tick, what it's really all about. And I don't think, I mean, for the purpose of also, I don't think people just go around thinking about these things all the time. But in the idea that we are here more than just to take steps through life, going from one place to another, doing this, is this, we're not here to have this mundane existential existence where we just go through life, make the most of it, put our particular meaning to it, and we die.
But it's amazing even, I mean, how easy it is to fall into that trap of living on the surface of life and not really having a lot of depth
right.
or purpose.
I think a lot of intellectuals formulate a life of existentialistic thinking and movement. And then willingly they put it into poetry or literature or painting.
Well, at least, but I mean, in that regard, at least there's some kind of purpose. It may not be a spiritual purpose necessarily, but there is, you know, there's content, intellectual content being delivered to the world, creative content, which has its value. And, you know, in some of our previous lives, I mean, you know, on a general note, previous lives, I'm sure there are lives that have been lived in terms of people that are spiritual now, in their past lives, they may have been just intellectuals that haven't
right.
evolved to a level of spirit.
Well, and then, you know,
from
being
contributing
pure intellectuals and existentialists, the psyche of existence is that we look, the psyche of existence that we probe existence, we try to give it meaning, we try to contrast it. You know, if we're of a minority and we put into a painting the idea that there is black and white substance, and the painting's very abstract, but it's our social comment as to how we experience life as a minority or as somebody of color or as somebody of a certain nationality, an oppressed person, and we put that into a creative expression, whether it's art or music or something totally abstract and expressionistic, that can be a form of spirituality. Because
a form of spirituality.
A form of spirituality. Because it's the spirit expressing itself in terms of the psyche of existence and how that existence is subjective, but within the context of a social environment. So if we really study those things, if we study art and we look deeply into the symbolism of art, what people are really trying to say, and we have this maybe abstract picture in front of us, and someone says, oh, this picture is called religion. And somebody's looking at these bars of colors and different lights and contrasts. There's nothing really on the canvas that looks comprehensible. And they go, religion? Religion. Yes, this is this person's concept of religion. And you start to look deeply into the colors, into the symbols. And maybe a wise interpreter can explain the painting to you. And suddenly you're looking at it and you're going, you know, I this is no longer abstract. I see the spirit in this painting. I see the meaning of religion. I see the contrast within existence, the opposing forces, the duality. I can see the wholeness of life in this painting. And then suddenly the painting takes on a spiritual essence that you would have never thought otherwise. So I think some of the
and the
things,
lesson here is to learn how to analyze art.
You know,
take some classes. That's the message today. Really about. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. Well, sure.
Well, in terms of being that kind of artist that enriches humanity with art and the complexity of the human mind, you know?
Yeah, it is. When you have somebody like Joseph Campbell,
but
who talks about mythology and the art of storytelling and how that's handed down into the different aspects of the act of creation on the planet, and how that's expressed itself throughout time and space. He even was a promoter of Star Wars as part of that mythology. But this was a man who studied the origin of creation, not like a archaeologist, but as a fabulist, as somebody who studied the art of storytelling and mythology. And how the human mind, the primitive human mind, comprised a construction of ideas and that outline themselves into a narration, a story that helps us to understand where we came from. Now, is that a form of earthly spirituality?
Earthly spirituality.
But a form of mysticism, mm-hmm. too, because there's gods and goddesses. There's elements from the other world, the ether world, the etheric realms that play a large part in our physical experience. So we take on these angels and guides and goddesses and spirits.
I'm looking at his birth date, if you're wondering what I'm doing here. Joseph Campbell. Do you know it?
I don't know it. I'm not sure what he was
Okay, born. Go ahead. Anyway, keep talking. I'm looking up here.
But he's just one person that explained that McKenna or something like that.
Hold on.
A great speaker, but also a man that believed in taking mushrooms and
right. Which, so,
but
the point is, there's levels that people, you know, I mean, these were high level intellectual.
Oh, fascinating!
Intellectuals that contributed greatly to the planet. However, is it reaching the apex of spirituality?
Well,
you know, maybe
perhaps.
Maybe not. Yeah, Terence McKenna is who it is.
Yeah, and I recommend people listening to him. I mean, aside from his politics and his belief in hallucinogenic mushrooms and things like that.
So it's interesting. Go ahead.
His discussions are fascinating about life, and he has a large following. Unfortunately, he died of a brain tumor, but when you listen to him speak, he has an intellectual spirit energy going. It's a contrast between the intellect and spirit and mysticism. And that whole concept of existence. And when he talks, I mean, it's like stream of consciousness. Mm-hmm. But he's very well studied, and he was very well learned, and he was sought after to speak. And he was, I think, mainly self-educated, but I have a certain verbal brilliance too.
Definitely.
I would consider the essence of spirituality as well, as much as reading Thomas More and Utopia. Or St. Augustine, or any of the great writers that discuss spirit and religion and philosophy, who devoted their lives to the concept of spirituality, to the concept of one's connection to God. Even Einstein came to the conclusion that there was an origin of some God figure, and so in the infinite spaces of his mind, in the physics of his calculations, he also considered a mysticism beyond science, and that was amazing. I think too, if you really study him and look at his energy, he seemed to have a rounded figuration of life, and so again, you could say he was a scientist. But he was a philosopher, and he was a mystic in some respects.
So Joseph Campbell, he has an interesting birth date, 3/26/1904. But he's 25/7, if I added that up, 11/21/25/7.
Yeah,
so
that spirituality.
Right.
And what year was he born?
1904. It's interesting because he's got all the numbers leading up to 7. In his birth date code somehow. I mean, his higher number, except one, his higher, unless you count the century, but his higher number on the transcendent side is 5 and 3, 2, 6, 4. So
he had a great
set of
interviews with Bill Moyers another fine commentator and one of our leading good minds. He's written quite a number of books and given a lot of lectures as well, Bill Moyers. And 1904 comes to a five, which...
And he was married to a choreographer dancer, Jean Erdman.
Yeah.
Did you know?
Yeah. Ultimately, so, you know, he was also considered a little bit anti-Semitic. There's things about Joseph Campbell that
really
are kind of annoying, but he, brilliant mind, and his book, Hero with a Thousand Faces, I think it's called, is that the name of it? Hero with a Thousand Faces, and amongst other books that he's written, that are very fascinating.
Yeah, Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Yeah, that are fascinating and well detailed and enriched. His tapes that he tells, he has several tapes that you could experience where he lectures, and his language and storytelling is amazing. He has a kind of a strange voice. It was almost feminine. It was kind of a high voice, if you will, but there was a mellowness to it, and there was still a certain depth in his narration. But he was a great believer in the handing down of the oral tradition of storytelling.
And he was friends with John Steinbeck.
It's John Steinbeck, and yeah. And John Steinbeck, now that total social observer, he was a man that was of the earth. His religion was questionable, but I think he was born a Catholic, but he was for the migrant worker. He was earthy. He had a certain spirituality about the earth and the planet. So Mice and Men and The Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden. I mean, East of Eden it wasn't really a religious book. It was about two opposing brothers, but the idea of his ability, and he only had like an eighth grade education, this man.
It's amazing, isn't it?
But if you read his work, just like Jack London, who I think he even had less than an eighth grade education.
They're all in that same area too, isn't that funny? Jack London and John Steinbeck, in that whole Monterey, like Northern California area.
Jack London, socialist, was a socialist. But still, he was the rugged individual, Jack London, called the Wild and Seawolf and things like that. He was an individual. To Build a Fire, one of his short stories, To Build a Fire, is one of the most famous short stories in the history of American literature. And it's all about the survival of building a fire. And so he was a very rugged individual, but socialist at heart. Martin Eden was one of his first books. It was a kind of an autobiographical book. And that was kind of a book that depicted his existence. And he had a woman editor that helped him along. But still, did he have, he had, I think, a wolf cabin or something that burned down. There was a tremendous fire. He had a controversial love life. But he was still a rugged individual. John Steinbeck travels with Charlie. He went across the United States to experience his connection with his fellow man, with his dog Charlie. Was that a religious odyssey of some sort? Was that his Homer endeavor to go through America and to discover himself and to come back again? I think we all go on these spiritual odysseys, and we all have a certain intellectual capacity in some regard. All of us have to have some form of intellect, whatever it may be, that involves itself in religion. I once met a man who's he did knots, you know, like sea knots, and that was his religion.
What do you mean tying knots?
Tying knots. He was a master at knots. And Don Knotts. He was a master at the bum. He was very funny, actually. I liked Don Knotts. I liked Don Knotts. But and he won a lot of Emmys, you know, for his performances. Burning Fight. And he had a certain spirit. He had a certain spirit of energy, as at least as his persona, as the character he created. But
what do you mean?
What's that?
Wasn't he mean?
Well, I met him, and he was mean to me.
Yeah, I know. He was mean to you when you were a child.
He was mean to me. I approached him at a restaurant, and he gave to an autograph, and I was only about 10, and he gave me the dirtiest look not to come near him, and I didn't. I backed off because he was not one to give out autographs, at least at that moment in time. But it didn't change my idea about him. I think he was a very, very wonderful comic. And you know, people like Lon Hardy, gentle spirits, the comedians that lifted the world up with comedy, you know, people would call them angels. There were some massive crowds that greeted them by the thousands and thousands. They still have a Lon Hardy fan club that meets, Sons of the Deserts, that is still devoted to these two gentle spirits, at least on camera. They were different. Oliver Hardy had his problems. Dan Laurel was a little bit more gentle, I think. But they had their situation, but still considered spiritual beings. So when we get, you know, Robin Williams, you know, the master of comedy who broke through comedy and was such a genius at improvisation and was so talented and yet was so troubled. You know, the idea of the flesh and the spirit, it's amazing. When we get to people like the flesh and the spirit, when we get to people like Charlie Rose or Travis Smiley, and, you know, and unfortunately because of their sexual, you know, deals going on, they all got destroyed.
Travis Smiley did too, huh?
He defends himself. And he said he had consensual sex with his subordinates, but he said everything was consensual. He doesn't have any idea where, you know, he abused or exposed or did anything that wasn't consensual. You know, they all have their points. Charlie Rose doesn't admit to being innocent. He said, okay, I did it, you know. And
he had pretty egregious offenses. I mean, compared to Al Franken, which just seemed like it was, you know, maybe a couple of
incidents, not that it's any excuse
to be inappropriate, but Charlie Rose was like, I mean, he did all kinds of, I mean, he was,
took showers.
Yeah,
and,
it was bad.
I mean, all this is public knowledge now. But when we get into the idea, but this is again the idea of the body and the spirit.
Right.
You know, if you just look at Tavish Smiley and or you look at Charlie Rose, and you look at them as commentators and interviewers, you think, wow, what great, this is terrific. These people,
right, and they're making a great contribution to society by doing the work that they do and enriching people's lives in,
right,
you know, in an intellectual
right
capacity. But then on the side, they're, you know, their personal lives are a mess.
You know, you get into things like Martin Luther King, and he's great. And
right, but he had affairs and was cheated,
you know,
on his wife. So.
Yeah. So, you know, it,
in terms of the alignment of physicality and spirituality, you've got to keep all of the areas clean. You have to be consistent.
At least you have to grow up and understand as you mature that there has to become a place where you're consistent with the idea of what spirit is really all about. And spirit is not about cheating. It's not about lying. It's not about indulging in your ego. It's about being consistent in tone, your connection to your fellow human
right,
being, and your integrity level.
Don't know about Joseph Campbell necessarily, or Terrence McKenna. Well, then, I mean, we know about the mushrooms with Terrence McKenna, but we're talking about Jack London and John Steinbeck, who made great contributions to American literature. But were their lives completely in line with being spiritual individuals? No. So as we were saying, making great contributions to the world doesn't get you off the planet necessarily. So again,
it's a matter of people like Picasso, who terribly abused. Yet you look at his art. Can you separate the art? Wagner.
You're right. I was like, let's get the composers in here too. We've got to balance the shows with all the literature. Unfair.
Yeah. What do we do?
Wagner,
do
Beethoven, who was completely.
Didn't he sleep?
I think he was like a peeping Tom.
He did okay. There were some sexual energies in there.
And Mozart and Vivaldi, who had a girls' school and was, you know.
Yeah.
Apparently not on the up and up completely, but
yeah,
you know, again,
yeah,
it,
you know, and so it comes, and then it comes down to the metaphor. If we look at spirit and body, if we look at spirit and body, how do we separate art from life? Do we discard the art, the essence of creation, because the artist himself or herself was corrupt? Or do we, you know, how do we put those two things together? I think our the mosaic of life is that you have to put out a picture that still is at the end of life, a concept of well-being, of wholeness, of congruity. And I think these are the things that are most important in terms of a brief discussion of spirit and body.
A brief discussion of spirit and body. Well, we had a little time today to discuss, and we are back on there on Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. And hopefully we'll talk to some of you on Friday. Thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.